From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, let me tell you how important that is for us and how thankful we are that you have been generous. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, the White House press secretary assured an evangelical television network that the election of Donald Trump was God's will. Sarah Huckabee Sanders told the Christian television network that, quote, God wanted Donald Trump to become president. I'm assuming that this must be the flip side of all those conversations she must have had with her father about why God wanted Mike Huckabee to not become president. A priority of the nationwide theocratic campaign Project Blitz is injecting conservative Christianity into every classroom. Proposed laws in numerous states got a boost in the form of a presidential tweet gushing about a return to teaching Bible literacy in public schools. Except a lot of public schools already offer such classes, and there are no restrictions on others doing so. The agenda here is not literacy. It is indoctrination and a narrow sectarian understanding of biblical teachings. This is one to keep a close eye on. And in Holland, a church service to protect an asylum-seeking family has finally ended after 96 days. Because Dutch law says police cannot enter a house of worship during services, the Bethel Church has been going nonstop since October 26th. Now, the government has agreed to give the family the church has been sheltering and other asylum seekers more time to stay in the country and make their case. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. From our nation's capital.
This program launched on January 15th, 2006, broadcasting nationally on the Air America Radio Network. Through many twists and turns, challenges and changes, we've kept at it. Now, normally, we always pause to mark the anniversary of this show, taking time to look back as well as to look ahead. But in what may well be yet another sign of the frenzied policy-by-tweet environment we now find ourselves having, January 15th has come and gone. It slipped right past us this year. So this week, I want to wish us a belated happy anniversary, to express deep gratitude to the many, many listeners who have stayed with us all of these years and who have made the program possible with generous financial support. Interfaith Alliance has been the sponsor of State of Belief Radio since the very beginning, and we received critical help from Auburn Seminary in New York City when we needed it the most. Most of our programs are available online at stateofbelief.com, but some of the very earliest have not yet been posted, and I'd like to share some of our first interviews in the weeks and months ahead as a concrete way of grounding ourselves as well as reminding ourselves both of how much and how little things really have changed. In January 2006, I spoke with writer Esther Kaplan, whose book With God on Their Side, How Christian Fundamentalists Trample Science, Policy, and Democracy in George W. Bush's White House, had just been released in paperback. Her insights certainly gave ample warning of what was likely to come next, and we'll revisit that conversation on this week's show.
So much of my previous world felt wrapped up in this box of certainty, and everything was right or wrong, black and white. I had all the answers, but what I realized was that if you have all the answers, what do you need faith for?
Amber Cantora was born into a family headed by a top executive at the anti-gay culture war organization Focus on the Family. Her journey from those beginnings to where she finds herself today, at peace, openly gay, married, and speaking out to help others, is chronicled in her first book, Refocusing My Family, Coming Out, Being Cast Out, and Discovering the True Love of God. Next month, Amber will publish Unashamed, a coming-out guide for LGBTQ Christians, and we'll get a preview as part of our ongoing series affirming the full value of LGBTQ persons within and beyond organized religion, whosoever you love. But first,
with faith in God, with fidelity to country, and with the fighting spirit I got from my mother, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
The race for the White House has begun. And a number of Democratic politicians have already thrown their hats in the ring. Now, the last few campaign cycles were noteworthy for how predictable it became for Republicans to declare their candidacies with lengthy religion-based explanations at what had led them to the decision. So far this year, it hasn't gone that far with Democratic candidates, but is the God talk increasing? Religion News Service national reporter Jack Jenkins has been keeping track of the announcement so far. Jack joins us right now on State of Belief Radio, and we are so glad to have you back, Jack.
Always glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Which candidates have caught your eye so far?
Well, if we're talking about God talk, the one that seems to have come out the strongest in terms of their announcement speech is Kamala Harris. She referenced God a few times, actually, in her announcement speech recently, usually couching it in a social justice way. Mm-hmm. So she was kind of talking about how, you know, this difference between unity and division and how, you know, sometimes an oppressor might try to divide the oppressed. And she talked about how, you know, when people, when abolitionists spoke out about civil rights, she said that their oppressors said they were dividing the races and violating the word of God. And then she quoted Frederick Douglass by saying, to love the religion of Jesus is to hate the religion of the slave master. And then she stared directly into the camera as she did that and then got a huge applause line. And just a couple of lines later, she actually cited her faith as one of the core elements of, you know, inspiring her to run for president. And, you know, she has an interesting history on her own, and she grew up, you know, attending a Hindu temple and a Baptist church. But in terms of claiming it that so fervently in her announcement speech, she seems to, you know, have spoken the loudest. But I can tell you right now, she's not the only one.
Mm-hmm. Does that feel different from other recent campaign cycles?
My general impression is that there seems to have been a kind of embrace of, you know, progressive religious language. It's not that Democratic candidates in the past wouldn't reference faith in their announcement speeches or in their campaigns. It was just that it was almost as if there's, you know, a reference to American civil religion, the idea of God bless America, quote unquote. You know, these sorts of phrases and terms that often get embedded within political and presidential rhetoric. These seem a little bit different. I mean, Kamala Harris in particular, you know, making sure to claim, you know, faith as a component of the social justice movement, of resisting oppressors. I mean, that's a really hearty embrace of God talk in a way that you haven't necessarily seen in previous election cycles.
Yeah.
And I'll note that, again, she's not the only one.
Tell us some of the others you've watched.
Right. So, I mean, Julian Castro, actually, his announcement process was a repeated reference to faith. When he announced his exploratory committee, he did it in front of a picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe, a Catholic visage that's very important, particularly in Hispanic and Latin American Catholics. And he made that announcement of his exploratory committee on the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, when he made his official presidential announcement this month, he made it in a place called Plaza Guadalupe, which was right across the street from Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, and he mentioned that he was baptized there. And I actually have spoken with Secretary Castro about this, so stay tuned for more on that. But it's clear that, you know, he was not shying away from his Catholic faith and also how his Catholic faith intersects with his identity and his heritage. And so I think, you know, he in particular did that. Then you have Elizabeth Warren, who, when she released her video announcing her candidacy, or at least, you know, her exploratory committee, it was still effectively a campaign video. Not only did it include a line about how, you know, she doesn't like politicians who otherize or demean those who pray differently, it also included a shot of a man in a church with a cross behind him, and it included a clip of Warren standing in a church pulpit holding a Bible, hugging someone. And that's something she's done in the past when she speaks in faith context, is that she actually waves a Bible around. I actually witnessed that around this time last year when she and Cory Booker both spoke. And then you have Kirsten Gillibrand, who, you know, was raised Catholic and she attends Bible study a lot. And her announcement video didn't reference faith per se, but a few days after, you know, she made her announcement that she was running for president, she was at this conference that included Reverend Al Sharpton, a King Day public policy forum, and she was straight up preaching at the crowd at that group, you know, like referencing spiritual armor, saying we'll put on the breastplate of righteousness. And again, that was kind of in this social justice context. It's embracing this sort of progressive faith, articulations where, you know, the idea of being progressive and being a person of faith isn't just something that people are comfortable with. It's something that people are deeply embracing. So those are the kind of the main hits. Now you also have Tulsi Gabbard, who announced her candidacy and immediately was beset with a lot of criticisms from progressives, allegations of past affiliations with Hindu nationalism, which she has since refuted, actually in an op-ed at the Religion News Service, saying that those are allegations of, quote, religious bigotry, as she was phrasing it. And so religion has also been a part of her campaign at this point as well. So there's been a lot of God talk.
Is there any particular significance you find in the trend that you're talking about right now?
So this is speculation, but as someone who has been covering faith communities, both in conservative and progressive circles, for a few years now, honestly, what it seems like to me is I have watched politicians, many of whom are now presidential candidates, over the last few years, actually show up to a lot of protests and demonstrations against the Trump administration, and, you know, state level demonstrations and protests that are organized by, you know, the religious left, progressive faith advocates. And the progressive faith advocates have enjoyed a lot more prominence than they have in previous years during the Trump era, because they are a key component of the resistance. You know, Reverend William Barber who spoke at the 2016 Democratic National Convention and mentioned faith quite frequently, has become a fixture of the resistance in the Poor People's Campaign during the Trump administration. You see similar things with Reverend Tracy Blackman, with several other different faith advocates who have become the people that who host the protests that you see on television, on CNN, MSNBC, even Fox News. And so if that is what is energizing the Democratic progressive base, that these sorts of advocates and activists are the ones, including Linda Sarsour, who helped organize the Women's March, if these are the people who are helping, you know, really inspire a lot of progressives, then it makes sense that, you know, the candidates who, you know, start running for office on the Democratic ticket might, you know, give a nod to that activism. And, you know, you have seen a lot of these groups, a lot of these candidates, including Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, you know, show up to events and stand next to William Barber and others, have FaceTime with these groups. And so it's a long-winded way of saying that I kind of think that this is an overture to the kind of, you know, faith-rooted rhetoric and faith-rooted activism that has become, you know, ubiquitous under Trump. You know, the largest single, quote-unquote, religious group in the Democratic Party are the religiously unaffiliated, some of whom are atheists and agnostics, and some of whom just don't particularly claim one faith tradition. But they often are traditionally kind of, you know, irked when they see, you know, God invoked from a presidential podium or some sort of candidacy. But if you've got 2 years where, you know, the people who were, you know, shouting the loudest about some of things such as immigration or separation of families along the border, or the border wall, the people who were most fervently pushing back on that were these faith-rooted activists. You know, it's harder for people to say, you know, what I've been seeing on the ground is a lot of what we saw happen in North Carolina during the Moral Monday movement back in 2013, 2014, which is just this fusion of different progressive groups that are basically saying, look, I might, you know, the folks who might be deeply secular are saying to religious folks, like, hey, look, I might not get to the same conclusion you have, you know, through God, but, you know, it sure seems like we're on the same page here about, you know, certain ideas of financial reform or economic reform or LGBTQ equality. And if we're all on the same page, then I'll listen to you preach all day long. And so that is something I see occurring. Now, it doesn't mean it eradicates the tension you're talking about. I expect it to come up. But what I think is really interesting is that a lot of these progressive candidates, a lot of these Democratic candidates for office are already workshopping ways to talk to both groups at once. And, you know, every coalition has tensions, and I think the Democratic Party is already trying to address exactly what you're bringing up, and that bodes well for both groups if they want to form a coalition.
Jack, you recently wrote about Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Coons and his effectiveness across party lines. We've had him here on State of Belief. He seems to just really get it. He's unique in making these kinds of connections. He's doing it the right way, isn't he?
He's an interesting case, Senator Coons is, because, you know, he's not a Joe Manchin insofar as, you know, this Democrat that often occupies deeply conservative spaces. I mean, Senator Chris Coons still has 100% rating from Planned Parenthood Action Fund, right? He's consistently advocated for non-discrimination policies for LGBTQ activists. And yet he is one of these people who has become a key player in the U.S. Senate for forging bipartisan compromises. Now, some progressives will say, well, he's kind of been more centrist on issues like financial deregulation and immigration policy. But at the same time, he was one of the people that, you know, Senator Jeff Flake, before he left the Senate, came to when he needed to try to forge a compromise around the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court justice nomination. And they forged this, you know, what many people thought was weak, but still an FBI investigation of him. And the reason for a lot of those relationships, Coons told me, is that he spends a lot of time with people he disagrees with talking about faith. And so my gist from that story, from talking with him and talking with his Republican colleagues, is that it's easier for them to forge compromises when they both feel respected. And faith is one form of conversation through which you can do that. Now, Coons is not the only one. There's a lot of people that show up to these prayer breakfasts and these Bible studies and have faith conversations who are on both sides of the political divide in the Senate and in the House. But, you know, I do think he has carved out a niche that shows that you can even get the president to say nice words about you as a Democrat and get some legislation passed if you're willing to, you know, kind of have this sort of human connection with colleagues that includes faith conversations. Now, I want to be clear. I don't think that's going to cross all the divides in our House and Senate. But I do think he's a rare case where, you know, taking God talk seriously is one way into helping the government function more efficiently in a historically gridlocked time.
Jack Jenkins is an award-winning journalist and national reporter at Religion News Service. Jack, you're an articulate observer at the complicated intersection of American religion and politics. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Amber Contarno will be here to preview her forthcoming book titled Unashamed, a coming-out guide for LGBTQ Christians. And we'll rewind to January of 2006 for one of the first interviews ever heard on this program. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Growing up gay in a conservative religious environment tends to be a painful and even dangerous experience. For many, perhaps most, who come from that kind of background, abandoning faith may be the only way to go. For others, though, the unique challenge of integrating identity, sexuality, and religion can be overwhelming. Offering guidance and encouragement for those who are drawn to that second path is a new book titled Unashamed, a coming-out guide for LGBTQ Christians, and I am delighted to welcome the author, Amber Contarno, to State of Belief Radio. Amber, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
I think it's important to talk about where you came from, because it helps explain where the book came from. So would you start with some biographical information, and we'll go from there?
Absolutely. I was raised in Colorado Springs, Colorado, which is and continues to be a very conservative, evangelical-based religious town. It also has a high military population, and so back when we moved there in 1991, it started to become kind of the epicenter of Christian ministries as a whole, and that was also about the time that Focus on the Family transplanted from Southern California to Colorado Springs. And so my father has worked for Focus on the Family for over 30 years and continues to this day, and that was very much the culture in which I was raised. I was homeschooled all my life. I had a stay-at-home mom that raised us. My dad worked at Focus on the Family, and I was really kind of cocooned in this Christian bubble that kind of ideally protected us from what they would call the outside world. And really, everybody that I surrounded myself with were kind of either people that were like us or that my parents wanted me to become like. And so I was really, my world was very, very small. And I really was not exposed to much. I was pretty sheltered and therefore did not have the knowledge and the skill that I needed to be able to identify my sexual orientation from a young age.
How powerful a force was shame in keeping you isolated and unable to imagine a full life for yourself?
Oh, my goodness. Shame was everything. From the time I was, I mean, as long as I can remember, shame was a big part of, I think, just our culture. I don't know that it was even really recognized for what it is, but I can think of feeling shame from the time I was elementary age, and that certainly played a huge role in my development and certainly in my coming out. My parents actually even found out about my first girlfriend before I came out to them, several years before I officially came out, and they said, don't ever tell anybody about this because it will ruin your reputation forever. And so that caused me to even retreat further into the closet because of that shame of the fact that you could not have both faith and your sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it kept me captive and silenced for a very long time and did a great deal of harm because when you've kind of been taught to hate this certain group of people, you know, they wouldn't say the word hate, but that's kind of the underlying message that you receive. And so when you're taught to hate that, and then you realize that that person is you, you start to hate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I turned that inward and dealt with a great deal of depression and anxiety and PTSD and self-injury and just self-hatred as a whole.
Yeah. Did you have the feeling at that time that you were the only person trapped in your set of circumstances?
Yes, absolutely, because I had no contact with other people who were like me. I had no idea that there was a whole world of LGBT people of faith out there. I felt like I was the only one that could ever show up gay in a, you know, conservative Christian family, and it was extremely isolating.
I do want to emphasize that you tell your story in much more detail in your first book, Refocusing My Family, Coming Out, Being Cast Out, and Discovering the True Love of God. I think it could be immensely useful for some of the people hearing this conversation, so I want to make sure they know it's out there. Amber, a lot of people free themselves, but find that they need to leave religion behind to be really free. How were you able to take faith with you into your new authentic life?
You know, I've met a lot of people that have left the faith, and I can't say that I blame them for that, because there's a lot of religious trauma involved for many people, including myself. But I was very fortunate to have a very deep and personal relationship with God from a very young age,
mm-hmm.
and that was something that carried me even through my teen years. And so many times when I didn't feel safe enough to talk about what I was going through with anybody, you know, especially my family, I would just take that to God, and I would take it to my journals, and I would spend hours and hours and hours just sitting by myself with my journal. And I think those years were really fundamental for me to be able to then hold on to that faith in those trying times, in those moments. And that doesn't say that I haven't done deconstructing of my faith and that I haven't, you know, let go of some of those old beliefs, but mm-hmm. it certainly has been a process, and it's just something that I've never been able to fully let go of because of that personal relationship that I had for so many years.
How did you deal with your family? I mean, they were a source of helping you feel shame and to feel like someone that has gone wrong and can't be righted. How did you work through this with your family?
Well, it was a very difficult process. My family and I now no longer have contact at all. I haven't had contact with them in a good 4 years or so. When I came out to them initially, I knew it was going to be difficult. I knew they wouldn't necessarily understand or agree. And I think in the back of my mind, somewhere deep inside of me, I knew that it could potentially cost me everything,
mm-hmm.
But I was not prepared for the fact that it actually would. And the day that I came out to my parents, they compared me to murderers and pedophiles and said, "We feel like you've died. How dare you do this to our family? This is so selfish, and you're an embarrassment to us." And so it just ripped me apart. And for a number of months, we tried to kind of find some kind of common ground, you know, of where we could agree to disagree, and it just never happened. They wanted me to completely change, and they became very passive-aggressive and very hurtful with their words and their actions, and it just came to such a toxic place that I could no longer deal with it. And so I had a number of, it was probably close to 2 years that we stayed in contact, but it was very strained. It was not nearly as frequent as it used to be. We used to talk all the time and see each other all the time, and these conversations just got further and further between each other. And eventually, once I got married to my wife, mm-hmm. I had no family at my wedding whatsoever.
Mm. Amber, please talk about why you thought it was important to write this book.
Because what I've found is, one, people do still feel very isolated. They don't have stories that are helping them realize they're not alone. And two, after I wrote my first book, Refocusing My Family, which is my memoir and my story, as I toured and traveled the nation, I found that a number of people were seeking just answers and guidance for how to navigate this unexpected journey. And so this book is a compilation of all those most frequently asked questions, and as well as a lot of other people's stories who allowed me to share them. And it's helping them get practical tools and tips and just a holistic approach to how to navigate the whole coming out journey.
Mm-hmm. The question always comes up, why is it important to come out? Will you address that?
You know, what I have found, not only personally but in the people that I've met, is that coming out is important for your self-worth, for your self-dignity, for your self-respect, and just for your overall physical and mental health. I've met countless people who ended up having chronic illness because they kept this piece of them inside for so long, trying to conform to the social norm. And when we come out, even though it may not be accepted by everyone, you are living your truth, and it is the most freeing thing you will ever do. And so as we hold those things in, it never produces good fruit. It only produces bad fruit. Fruits of self-hatred, fruits of risky behavior, you know, just really dark places the majority of the time, and that will affect you over the long term. And so I encourage people, when they feel ready and when they feel safe, to come out, because even if it costs you something, what you gain is still so much greater.
Are there pitfalls that you warn readers about?
Yes. Probably one of the biggest ones is people that want to debate theology. And often when it comes between parents and children, the children feel like they owe it to their parents to engage in this kind of dialogue. And really, they don't. Rarely does that ever produce anything positive. And if somebody is dead set in what they believe, nothing you say is going to sway them, no matter how good your theology debate is. And so what I tell people is to instead give them resources that will point them in the right direction. And I have a number of those listed on my website. But give them those resources to read for themselves. Because if they truly want to understand and they truly care about you, they will go read those. And if they don't, then you're avoiding the heartache of feeling backed into a corner for something that you shouldn't have to defend. You shouldn't have to defend who you are as a human being.
Have you ever talked with a person in the LGBTQ community that has come out and says they wish they had never come out?
I don't think so. I think there are people who, for a time, and you know, I can't even say that for myself, for a time, you're like, did I make a mistake? Because you're in the midst of so much grief and loss and rejection that you sometimes wonder if you made the wrong choice. But I think for any of us that have pushed through those difficult seasons, we realize that it's the most rewarding thing we could have ever done. And we wouldn't, most of the people that I meet say, I wouldn't trade it for the world. And that would go the same for me. I would never go back to the life that I had before to be closeted and wear that mask of perfection and that smile all the time and feel so alone. This has been one of the best things I've ever done in my life, even though it's also been one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. It has cost me greatly, and yet I wouldn't trade it.
You're a member of the LGBTQ community. You've been deeply hurt by organized religion, and in spite of that, you've continued to be a person of faith. Why?
There are a lot of people that leave the faith, and I don't blame them for that. But somebody needs to stay and transform it from the inside. And there are a handful of us that have done that, not simply, you know, partially because of just our deep love for God, but also because we believe it's worth fighting for. And so we're trying to look at the scriptures in a different way. We're trying to encourage a more progressive lens through which we view life and view faith, but also encouraging people that you can be both LGBT and and a person of faith, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's no conflict with that. There's nothing to be ashamed of. God loves you and made you the way that you are and has intentionally created you as part of the diverse family of God for a reason. And so I encourage people to embrace that and to display it to the world without shame, because it is a beautiful thing when you start to see all the different colors and shapes that that are made up in the family of God.
Well, you've written a great book, a very helpful book. What would be the ideal response to readers of your book?
I hope that this serves as a guide to them, that they feel like I'm walking along beside them, because, you know, as people reach out to me, I try my hardest to respond to everyone in turn and meet them where they're at. And yet this is a guide that's so much more than what I can give them in an email. And so I hope that as they read it, they feel like I'm walking along beside them and that I'm giving them these tools and tips from my own experience and the experience of others that I've gotten to meet, and that it just gives them hope, that it gives them guidance, and that it helps them to be able to walk into freedom and love who they are without shame.
The book will be released on March 12th. Would you please tell our listeners how they can pre-order Unashamed?
They can pre-order now on Amazon. Type in Unashamed and either LGBTQ or my name, Amber Cantorna, it will pop up, and they can pre-order it today. And then they can also be watching online for events, because I will be touring and speaking as well. So they can be watching for events in their area, either by following me on social media at Amber N, as in Nicole, Amber N. Cantorna, or on my website as well.
Amber Cantorna is a writer, public speaker, and advocate for holistic self-acceptance and integrative religious faith. Her Pathos.com blog is called Refocusing My Family. The publication date for her latest, which is titled Unashamed, as Coming Out Guide for LGBTQ Christians, is March 12th. Amber, I am very grateful. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
State of Belief Radio was born on January 15th, 2006, as a way to engage in and help influence the national conversation around issues of religion, government, and politics. I want to rewind to one of the first interviews we ever aired. It seems like a lifetime ago that writer Esther Kaplan spoke to me about her book, With God on Their Side, How Christian Fundamentalists Trample Science, Policy, and Democracy in George W. Bush's White House. And yet I think it's more clear than ever that this nation is living every day with the consequences of not taking warnings like hers seriously enough. Here's that conversation from January 29th, 2006. You are careful to identify the Christian right as a political movement rather than a religious movement. Would you talk about that a second?
Well, I think this is the critical distinction, and it's one that I think on the whole the mainstream media misses. This is partly why we see very careful, uncritical coverage of the Christian right, because it's thrown to the religion reporters. It's seen as a religious movement. We respect tolerance and diversity in this country, as we should, so anything's fair game. The difference is this is a movement that's decided to enter the political realm. Christian right activists have taken over the GOP party apparatus at the state level. In the majority of states, they hold a sway, 44 states, I think they hold sway over party committees. They're electing people to public office, from county commissioners to school boards to Congress to the Senate to the White House. This is a movement that at times has retreated from public life, has been legitimately a religious movement, but right now has political goals, is doing political organizing, doing voter mobilization, lobbying in Washington, trying to pass legislation and public policy. They're a political movement now.
Now, you made a very convincing case in your book for George Bush's presidency being a primary reason for the success of the right in our nation. But I have to ask, who was driving whom? Was it Bush driving the right, or was it the right driving Bush?
You know, I think this is one of the great political mysteries of our moment. I'm one of those people who believes that when it comes to George W. Bush, you cannot separate his faith from his political uses of his faith. From months of his experience of becoming born again, he was serving as the evangelical liaison for his father's first presidential campaign. So we've never had a born-again George W. Bush who was not using that connection to the Christian right movement for political ends. I think that the shift that we've really seen is on the Christian right. You look at significant leaders like James Dobson, who is the head of Focus on the Family. This is someone who used to sit out of presidential races, who used to back Gary Bauer and other insurgent candidacies, people that came directly from the movement, was often throwing stones at the GOP leadership for not putting forward people who were conservative and, in his view, pro-family enough. And you look at his evolution. In this recent campaign in 2004, he actually stepped down from his post as president of Focus on the Family in order to form a 501c4, a political wing of his organization, in order to go to swing states and campaign for George W. Bush and other candidates of his liking, such as Tom Coburn, who won a Senate seat in Oklahoma. So it's really the Christian right that's made a big change in deciding we're going to play this game. We're going to be in there with the big boys now.
You understand the agenda of the Christian right as well as anyone, maybe better than most. How are they doing achieving their goals? I see a real euphoria among members of the religious right.
Well, yeah, I was at the recent March for Life, so-called, in Washington, D.C., and I am with you. The feeling was very upbeat, very triumphant. I think there's a feeling that things are going their way. I mean, I think it's two things. One is the concrete victories that they really might get the Supreme Court they've been dreaming about for more than a generation. The faith-based initiative channeling money their way, a complete remaking of the way U.S. foreign aid works, the defunding of family planning organizations, the funding of Christian missionary groups like Franklin Graham's outfit to the tune of tens of millions of taxpayer dollars. But I think it's also just the tone that George Bush is someone who wears his religion on his sleeve, who constantly advocates for the validation of their worldview in the public square.
You have studied the religious right more than most people want to ever look at that movement. What has been your most frightening discovery?
I think one of them for me was definitely the realization when we look at the significant impact on public health issues, whether it's family planning, whether it's HIV prevention in Africa, where we're facing just a devastating humanitarian crisis there, that the ultimate goal is not to save lives and it is not to protect people's health, that the goal is to save souls, and that they're willing to put their political muscle behind programs such as abstinence only that are going to harm people, that are going to result in more infections, more deaths, and that the outcome is just not relevant to them. And I think that this is really disturbing because we're seeing a remaking of the government's public health apparatus according to this morality-based ideology. And the outcomes, I think, as the years go by, are going to become more and more devastating. The problem is that those kinds of facts, that what you're doing may be increasing deaths, may even be increasing abortions, that doesn't matter to them, I think is profoundly disturbing.
When you personally come away from encounters with the religious right, what is your emotion?
Well, it really depends. I mean, I'm Jewish. I'm from New York. My name is fairly unmistakably Jewish. I've had a number of very disrespectful encounters on that front of people wanting to pray for me, to save me. I think that that is rife within the movement, a disrespect for other people's faith, a disrespect for other people's belief systems. On the other hand, I certainly have met many people, as I'm sure you have, who are very well-meaning. They've opened up their crisis pregnancy center. They believe they're doing God's work. They believe that what they're doing is in the best interests of women. I believe that they're profoundly misguided, that they're doing a great deal of harm. But they are people who have dedicated their lives to service. There's something there that's very meaningful and that's worthy of respect. I think even with those people where I part ways is that they're, again, unwilling to look at the evidence, to really look in the face at the outcomes of the policies and ideologies that they're promoting.
My guest has been Esther Kaplan, author of With God on Their Side, George W. Bush and the Christian Right. Esther, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for the wonderful work you're doing on this program.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support for this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, thank you. Thank you very much on behalf of every one of our listeners. Now, if you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein, who celebrated a birthday a few days ago, and after posting reminders of his special day all over my computer, I forgot. But I do wish him a happy birthday with gratitude for the genius he brings to State of Belief. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.